Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. Connecticut Senator Christopher Dodd is retiring after 30 years in office, elected to the Senate in the same year that Ronald Reagan was elected president. He leaves with one of the signature pieces of Obama-era legislation bearing his name, the Financial Reform Bill. But ironically, he has said the Banking Committee, which he chairs, has been the least favorite of his three committees to serve on, behind Foreign Relations and the HELP Committee, Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions. Dodd is a legislator's legislator. As most of the political class seems to shun the idea of compromise, he embraces it. He worked to cultivate Republicans every step of the way toward the bank reform bill, although that sometimes put him at odds with other progressive Democrats like Russ Feingold and Elizabeth Warren. And Dodd is working to the last of his Senate days. Just the other day, he announced a banking committee hearing into the shoddy and perhaps illegal rapid foreclosure practices that have forced Bank of America to temporarily suspend all foreclosure proceedings nationwide and other big banks to cut way back. We're glad to have the chance to talk to Senator Dodd at least one more time in office. Senator, thanks a lot for coming on. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian, very much. Pleasure to be with you.
First on the news of the day, the new foreclosure crisis. Are the same big banks that helped bring down the economy with irresponsible lending and investing now trying to give struggling families the bum's rush without due process?
Well, it appears that way. I mean, this goes back a long time. I, candidly, when I became chairman of the Banking Committee in January of 07, it seemed to me, in fact, in 06, Jack Reed of Rhode Island, Jim Bunning, the Republican of Kentucky, had been actually held hearings when Dick Shelby was still the chairman of the committee on the mortgage crisis as it was beginning to emerge. And about 80 hearings we held in the year of 07. Primarily on the mortgage residential crisis. In fact, we tried to get these major lenders in the spring of 07 to reach some accommodation in some way in which you could begin to at least keep people in their homes who could stay in their homes and those who could not to move the process forward. So it's been an ongoing problem and one that I feel strongly that had we addressed early on and put a tourniquet on, the crisis that we're facing could have been, still would have been a crisis, but never to the magnitude that we've currently felt it. So this issue of obviously the banks gone wild here on the foreclosure process requires our attention. Now, let me just quickly add that I think there's a legitimate concern that by having a nationwide moratorium on all banks engaged in this practice may be going too far, because clearly there are lending institutions that are not engaged in these shoddy practices, and to require all banks to shut down all foreclosure processes could have some very harmful economic effects in the country. So I want to make sure we strike the balance. That's what the hearing will try and do, and right after the election.
In holding the hearing, do you hope to just spotlight the issue, or are there questions that you actually don't know the answer to that you're hoping to learn the answer to?
Well, that's exactly right. The latter is clearly the case. And as you point out earlier, I'll be leaving the Senate after that lame duck session is over. And so it'll be incumbent upon the next committee chairman, Tim Johnson or Richard Shelby, depending upon the outcome of the elections, to pick up on what's occurring. Clearly, one of the major problems we've got is with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, because the pressures on them are going to be phenomenal. I noticed that they're also warning now lenders that they're going to penalize them for actions that they may have taken, contrary to what the rules of the road are when it comes to foreclosures, to avoid them even being hit further and placing greater pressures on the housing market. So clearly, we need to come up with an alternative idea for housing financing. Fannie and Freddie are just, you can't perpetuate that system. But we need something to replace it. And clearly, looking at Fannie and Freddie and the cost to the American taxpayer, also part of this question as well, one of the reasons why we need to have a sense of balance in terms of how we treat the foreclosure crisis.
Let me digress for a minute into a political question, and my guest is outgoing Connecticut Senator Christopher Dodd. You mentioned either Richard Shelby or Tim Johnson would be taking over the Banking Committee chairmanship depending on the outcome of the election. Obviously, you're a Democrat. You're going to support Democrats. Republicans are going to support Republicans. But at the level of the Banking Committee and that whole realm of policy and legislation, what do you think is at stake for the country in having Richard Shelby of Alabama as the chairman as opposed to another Democrat?
Well, again, I've worked with Richard Shelby rather closely. We've actually, despite our differences on some major bills, we've actually worked rather closely on many over the last 3 years. We've had about 40-some-odd pieces of legislation that have come out of the Banking Committee. 90% of it has been one in which we've reached bipartisan compromise. Now, the big issues, such as credit card reform, dealing with the financial regulatory reform, were more controversial and more partisan, unfortunately, at least in the votes. Actually, they were rather bipartisan in terms of the product that was produced. So I don't want to sit here and castigate, potentially a Republican chairman. And we've had our differences on these matters. And, for instance, coming up, I'm going to hold a hearing pretty soon, right after we get back, on Peter Diamond. Richard Shelby has expressed opposition to him being on the Federal Reserve Board. Here's a man who just won the Nobel Prize for Economics and written particularly about unemployment, which is one of the jobs of the Federal Reserve, is to deal with inflation and unemployment. And to suggest that someone's not qualified to serve in that post, having just won the Nobel Prize for Economics, it's almost humorous. But we're going to try and see if we can't get him confirmed before the Congress adjourns. So we have our differences, and I really wouldn't want to predict for you what the policy considerations would be, depending on who takes over as chairman.
Okay. Do you think that the opposition to Peter Diamond is genuine? Does it fit into a pattern that maybe you had to come up against as you were trying to work on the financial reform legislation? Because you worked hard, I think everybody gives you credit for this, to cultivate a bipartisan working group throughout that process with Shelby and Gregg and others and Corker. Do you think that they were torn between a desire to get something practical done for America and their party's strategy of the moment of just saying no, just saying hell no to anything that President Obama could get credit for?
It seemed that way to me. I could never quite figure out. Some I think the opposition is just ideological. It's just that the idea of having a stronger regulatory process that doesn't strangle innovation and creativity was just anathema to them. Sort of the Alan Greenspan approach. That is that a completely deregulated environment, let the market dictate the future, is certainly deeply troubling to me, and obviously one of the major causes for the problems we ended up in. But also, I think there was this political notion that don't give the Democrats any credit for getting anything done. The problem with that idea, in a sense, was they never offered an alternative. There never was an alternative to financial regulatory reform. It was strictly opposition, but there never was what you normally have is a substitute bill. It says we think that we ought to reform the system, but here's our substitute idea. There never was one. So it made it difficult to move through the process. But now if you're going to end up in a more, obviously, whether Democrats retain control or Republicans win, it is going to be a more divided Senate, one way or the other. It's going to clearly require a lot more cooperation. I almost think, Brian, that one of the problems we had is that 60-40 breakdown were the worst two numbers you could have. In the 40, the Republicans had to stick together, couldn't lose a single vote in order to try and hold the line. Democrats needed all 60 to get anything done. Had there been 55-45 or 65-35, I think we might not have ended up in quite the situation we did on so many pieces of legislation.
Gosh, does that kind of let voters off the hook a little bit in terms of going out and supporting Democrats to keep the maximum majority in the Senate this November?
No, I don't think that's going to happen. I mean, the reality is it's going to be the numbers are going to be less. Obviously, I hope we still retain a majority rule in the Senate for all the obvious reasons. But clearly the numbers are going to decline. It's not going to be 60-40. That much I can pretty much guarantee you. The question is it going to be 55-45 or something like that? I'm just trying to be realistic about it.
And then the Republicans won't want to be tagged with being the do-nothing Congress for the following election any more than the Democrats is what you're saying.
Exactly, exactly. At that point, then you've got a vested interest in trying to step up and get something done. Or they're going to that label of just do nothing, no alternative ideas, no suggestions. We never had an alternative idea in health care, never had an alternative idea in financial reform. It's one thing to say you're against what we did, but at some point you have to stand up and say what you're for. The idea that we would come out of a Congress doing nothing about health care, which is consuming as much of the gross domestic product of the country as it is and would continue to rise, and secondly, do nothing about financial reform in light of what occurred, I think the country would have reacted very negatively.
So you're for pragmatic compromise in an era of partisan posturing, but you were also roundly criticized by some Democrats for the compromises in the financial regulatory bill. From the reporting that I've seen, Elizabeth Warren had to keep going public with her strong spine to keep you from compromising away a Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Did you struggle with yourself over when no bill was worse than a watered-down bill?
Well, I always thought people would consider the sidelines and pontificate. I mean, I've got to sit there and produce 60 votes. And it's legislating is a lot more complicated than issuing press releases and trying to keep those votes together. We ended up with a very strong consumer protection agency. I go back almost 20 years in advocating that kind of a role, long before some other people did. And what we insisted upon with it is that there be a presidentially appointed director, that there be independent funding, independent rule writing, and enforcement authority, including those over your non-banks. And we did all of that. That's what I set out to do, and that's exactly what the bill ended up doing.
And you've said the way that the president appointed Elizabeth Warren to circumvent Republicans in the Senate, possibly blocking or filibustering her appointment to head the agency, his end run around that leaves the agency vulnerable. Why doesn't that actually strengthen it for showing some muscle and putting a boss above the boss who needs confirmation?
Well, because the bill requires Senate confirmation, and you got to be honest about these things. We've got to have a confirmable director. If they want to nominate Elizabeth, I'm all for it. I try to help her get through. But my job is to also give the administration my candid assessment about whether or not people are confirmable or not. I don't know if Elizabeth is or not, but it seems to me that longer that post remains vacant, then that part of the bill remains vulnerable. And clearly, from the very beginning, the Republicans' opposition to this bill was almost entirely focused on the creation of a Consumer Protection Bureau. It'll be the primary target if they gain control of the Senate, and we don't have a director in place and not have established the foundations of the Consumer Protection Bureau. Then they will go after this. They go after it anyway. But if you have it, we haven't really even set it up yet. You haven't moved on it, then it creates far greater vulnerabilities, in my view. That's why I'm hoping that we'll get a director named, including possibility of Elizabeth Warren, in the lame duck, so we can move that if we can to that period of time and end up with a director earlier rather than later.
Outgoing Connecticut Senator Christopher Dodd, my guest on WNYC. The Dodd-Frank reform bill may become your biggest legacy after the fact, but you said recently that of the three main committees that you've served on over the years, the Banking Committee was the least interesting to you. Foreign Affairs was more so, and the HELP Committee, Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions, was the most. You cited your work on the Family and Medical Leave Act in the 80s and 90s. Is that the single law that you're most proud of from your 30 years?
Well, I tried to explain in the sense of the body of work. Back in the 1980s, in 81, 82, Arlen Specter, who was then a Republican, I started the Children's Caucus of the Senate. Orrin Hatch and I wrote the first child care legislation in the 1980s. I did all the work on things involving pharmaceutical drugs and medical devices for children, infant screening, premature births, family medical leave. There's a whole body of work that goes over three decades in that area of family law and children, focused on children's issues. It's that body of work that I'm most proud of. It's the work I enjoyed the most. Foreign Relations Committee, I was a Peace Corps volunteer back in the 60s, a strong interest in Latin America, and so my work in the 1980s on the Central American conflicts and my subsequent work has also been a source of satisfaction. I've enjoyed the Banking Committee, but if you ask me to choose which committee would I, if I only could serve on one committee, which committee of those three would I serve on? It would have been the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee. For the body of work I've enjoyed the most working on, foreign relations was interesting, and banking was certainly important. But it was the least, the committee that had the least amount of interest in many ways. I did a lot of work on that committee, but it was not the committee that I enjoyed the work the most about.
What about the health care law enacted this year then? It took generations to get this kind of comprehensive health care system through Congress, but even supporters admit that it's a big, complicated, ugly thing that they'll have, many doubts about as it's implemented and will have unintended consequences. Do you feel triumphant about this law or something more muted than that?
Well, I call it a beginning, not an end. In the absence of doing anything, we'd be looking at a percentage of gross domestic product that was around 17 or 18%, and some predicted to get as high as 30%. if we didn't step up and try to deal with cost, accessibility, and the quality of health care. And so this is an issue of screaming for some answers. People going back to the days, well, Harry Truman, Dwight Eisenhower, Richard Nixon, Lyndon Johnson, Medicare, at least in part. Every administration, had one way or another, had tried to do something about this issue. And so it's been both a bipartisan concern, legitimately so, to try and come up with some answers to this. And so I'll be the first to admit that, look, we've got a long way to go. You're going to dial this thing different directions before you get done with it. But it is the beginning that we had to make. Someone had to step up and get this done. And I admire the fact that President Obama put as much on the line, as much at stake, with as much controversy, to get this moving in the right direction. That's not to suggest we're not going to make changes to this. Obviously, we'll have to as we learn more about how this is working in a very practical way. But in the absence of getting this bill online and moving, we'd still be where we were 2 years ago, consuming as much of our economy as healthcare was, lack of access, too many million Americans not having coverage at all, raising costs for everyone. So I believe it was the right thing to do. I'm proud to have been involved in it. I regret deeply that my best friend in the Senate, Ted Kennedy, was not alive to see the fruition of it, considering how much time he'd put into this over many decades. And when he asked me to take over his committee, to act as the acting chairman to get this job done, I was proud to do so.
And yet the health care law seems to be the main thing that has propelled the Tea Party to prominence. What does it say to you about America, about the American people, that covering Americans with health care, of all things, could be the source of such a pointed backlash?
Well, it's not uncommon. This has happened. Whether or not these are legitimate historical comparisons, I'll let others decide. Back in the late 1940s, when it took a courageous Republican by the name of Vandenberg to step up and help Harry Truman pass the Marshall Plan, only about 18% of the American people supported it. Why would you want to rebuild Europe, including Germany, or Japan for that matter, considering what we've been through and how much damage they'd caused to mankind? And yet Harry Truman insisted upon it. Some courageous Republicans stood up in the face of political opposition in the country and did it. Today, most Americans, I think, acknowledge it was the right thing to have done. The Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act of the 1960s. There were a lot of candidates in 1964, 65, 66 who were reluctant to acknowledge and stand behind those acts. In fact, we still lose seats in the country probably because of it. And yet, I don't know of anyone today that suggests we'd be a better country had we not passed the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act of the 1960s. Time and time again, historically, doing the right thing was not always the popular thing to do. I happen to believe that regarding health care and financial reform, the second thing more popular than the former, we did the right thing in both cases, and history will record that.
We're almost out of time. A couple of things real quick. First, back to financial reform. Under fire constantly, as you know, from both left and right, from the right for hobbling Wall Street with big new bureaucracies, from the left for watering down the Volcker Rule, but from both sides for not ending too big to fail. In your own estimation, did you end too big to fail?
I believe we did. And of course, the next crisis will determine whether or not we were successful at it. But I think that was a major vote. It was the first vote really cast in the Senate. Senator Shelby and I wrote together in a pass, I think, 90-5. And that is to end once and for all forever, that some institution becomes so big that it has the implicit or explicit guarantee that the federal government will bail them out. Today, we set up a process either through bankruptcy, which they go forward, or a wind down through resolution processes that will prohibit forever the federal taxpayer stepping up and doing what we had to do in the fall of 2008. But, Brian, I have to be the first to admit again, there will be another crisis. This bill doesn't end crises. What we try to do with this bill are four things. One, end too big to fail. Two, to make sure that we had transparency of exotic instruments. Three, that we'd have the oversight capacity, the systemic risk assessment, the overview, the early warning system. And third or fourthly, consumer protection. Those are the four major goals of the bill. And I believe the first was the one that we had to write into law in order to build bipartisan support, some bipartisan support for the bill, which we did.
And lastly, on Latin America, which you mentioned before, because it's under discussed and because you felt strongly about it when that was front and center in U.S. foreign policy, ultimately, did the U.S. do right over your 30 years in the Senate by our neighbors to the south? We're really so intertwined in ways that many people don't realize.
Well, in some ways we did and we didn't. I mean, ultimately ending the war in Central America that cost us dearly in the lives by, I think, making some false assumptions about the nature of those conflicts hurt us. I think we're still way behind the curve when it comes to dealing with Cuba. I would, for one, would lift all travel restrictions and begin to lift that embargo. I was just there for about 4 days, and it was incredible to me, you know, how these people still live. And while certainly the government down there is primarily responsible for it, I think we create change in that country by lifting the travel restrictions and modifying the embargo. But again, I'm probably a minority point on that one. And we need to reengage with the hemisphere again. I think the Obama administration tends to do that come January, to begin to reach out more. Brazil is becoming a major global influence. We have a tremendous amount of very creative governments, democratically elected governments in South America, more so than at any point in certainly most recent past history. So there's a lot to look forward to in improving the relationship. Clearly, Mexico, the bilateral relationship, has some huge problems on the border that need to be addressed. So my hope is the Obama administration will spend more time focusing on the region than we have in the past.
What's the one thing that we need, in your opinion, with respect to Mexico, between the drug violence and the immigration issues? It so matters to the United States. What would you do?
Well, the one thing we can control or try to control better is the guns. Most of the guns that are causing the violence in Mexico are coming from the United States. And whatever one's views may be on gun control, the idea that you have 7,000 gun shops along the border in Mexico, and that's what you have today in that 2,000-mile border.
That's on the U.S. Side.
That's on the U.S. side. And our ability to clamp down on that would be a significant step in reducing the violence. Now, clearly, we're also the major consumer of their drugs that come across, and efforts in that regard are also critically important. So we need to be far more aggressive, in my view, or you're going to end up with a failed state in Mexico if we're not careful.
Senator Christopher Dodd, outgoing Democrat after 30 years from the state of Connecticut. If we don't get to speak again before the end of the term, thank you for coming on in the years that I've been doing this show, and good luck to you.
Thanks very much, Brian. Thanks for having me on.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And coming up next, what happens after the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq? We will ask Gideon Rose, author of a new book called How Wars End. Stay with us.